morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In December, Donald Trump met with the CEOs of several high-tech companies, including Safra Catz, CEO of Oracle. After Katz was quoted as saying before joining the Trump transition team, "I plan to tell the president-elect that we are with him and we are here to help him in any way we can," a senior executive at Oracle publicly resigned from the company, posting his resignation letter on his LinkedIn page, outlining concerns over Trump's choice of cabinet, tax, and environmental policies, as well as the stoking of fear and hatred toward minorities. This morning, we talked with George Paulsner about why he could not abide by his boss's decision to support the Trump administration and why he decided to go public with his resignation. George, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara, and thanks for having me on the show.
And thanks for doing what you did. It was a very inspiring story to hear amidst a whole flood of not very inspiring stories or de-inspiring stories that we've been hearing over the last couple months. So what motivated you to do this?
Well, you know, really in connection with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s day today, I mean, just thinking about what he said, there comes a time when silence is betrayal. And I think about, you know, I look back on the life that I've had, and I also recognize that I have privilege, that I've at a point in time in my life and career where I was able to really make a strong statement on my way out the door. And I feel like I would have really brought dishonor to all of the people that paid and made great sacrifices and paid with their lives and endured so much suffering on behalf of the causes of justice and equality and finding peace and security for everyone. Not only in America and around the world. And so I wanted to especially what Safra did and said, I think that she made a mistake. I mean, there are many wonderful people of the Muslim faith that I've worked with at Oracle. There are people of color, and essentially normalizing the Trump administration and Donald Trump and all of the hate-fueled rhetoric that was, you know, central to his campaign and continues through all of his 3 a.m. tweets. I felt like I needed to make a very strong statement.
Which you certainly did. I'm going to read your statement that you wrote to your boss, Safra Catz, and then we can talk a little bit about what you perceive that she's doing and why you have some issues with that. And also, at some point, I'd like to talk about if you feel like you may be a role model for other people working in corporate America who might want to take on their bosses. But this is
a role model or a cautionary tale.
Right. We'll get to both of those. This is from George Paulsner, who is in governance and service delivery at Oracle, or was until recently. He says the subject is transition team, and he addresses this to Safra. "You were recently quoted, quote, 'I plan to tell the president-elect that we are with him and are here to help in any way we can,' end of quote, prior to joining the Trump transition team. Based upon Trump's own words and validated in his cabinet selections, he will seek to dismantle Social Security and Medicare, important retirement security for our aging and disabled populations. Trump stokes fear, hatred, and violence toward people of color, Muslims, and immigrants. It is well known that hate crimes are surging as he has provided license for this ignorance-based expression of malice. He disrespects Gold Star military families, women, and the disabled. He seeks to eviscerate environmental protections, the public education system, LGBTQ rights, and women's rights. His tax and economic policies will greatly increase the national debt while concentrating wealth, exacerbating an alarming growth of wealth inequality in America. I began with Oracle in 1993 and was proud to work among some of the best software development and operations engineers in the world. I've made significant contributions to Oracle along the way in my various roles ranging from consulting, product development, customer advocacy, program management, and now in cloud. I am not with President-elect Trump, and I am not here to help him in any way. In fact, when his policies border on the unconstitutional, the criminal, and the morally unjust, I am here to oppose him in every possible and legal way. Therefore, I must resign from this once great company, George A. Paulsner Governance Service Delivery at Oracle." So that's what you posted, not just on your LinkedIn page, but you also sent this to Safra. I'm wondering, did you get any response from Safra to this letter?
Not directly, but through my manager, and it was just very terse, and let's just say there wasn't an engraved gold watch.
Now, actually, I went on your LinkedIn page and I saw the letter, and I had posted something very positive about it, how, you know, I thought you were like a major role model for corporate America. And there were some other postings that were not quite as positive, and some of them were, in fact, quite negative. And I'm wondering how indicative of that was the response that you got from your colleagues and other people in the high-tech world?
You know, it's interesting. On the public comment board, you're absolutely right. I would almost say it was split 50-50 in terms of people that were detractors. And some people felt that politics doesn't belong on the LinkedIn platform, although I would argue that jobs, economics, and politics are very closely intertwined. But anyways, the private messages that I've received, both in email as well as private LinkedIn messages, were incredibly supportive. And I learned a lot. I learned a couple of things that were really unexpected. And one was, I do think a lot of my peers in the progressive space have really been in something of a state of shock. This election cycle, I think that we went into November 8th very hopeful of taking the Senate back, and certainly that we would be looking toward inaugurating our first woman president, and also thinking of, in terms of the generational impact that we would have in terms of appointing a strong Supreme Court justice that could help really further policies from the Supreme Court that would favor people over just the mindless pursuit of plunder and profit. And so the letter itself and a lot of the messages that I received were along the lines that this was a very inspiring and motivating act. It was catalyzing action, or at least showing people that there are things that we can meaningfully do in light of the dark times ahead, the challenging times ahead. So the other thing that I learned, Barbara, is, you know, when I think about the most vulnerable to the policies of this incoming administration, I really thought of the impoverished and certainly people of color and the Muslim community. But one of the letters that I received was from a research scientist who works in a red state. He's doing work in stem cell research. He's been subpoenaed by Congress because of the nature of his work. And in terms of a very vulnerable class of citizens, I had not even thought about climatologists or other people performing very important research with respect to cures for horrific diseases like Parkinson's or ALS. And they are now all very vulnerable to this incoming administration and the racist and regressive policies of a Department of Justice that would be potentially led by AG Sessions.
Well, your letter came out just shortly after the news was released that the Trump transition team had sent a letter to the Department of Energy demanding the names of everybody who worked at the department who had attended climate change conferences. And it's sort of that sent the same kind of chill through all those scientists there and scientists across the nation that you were describing that you received in your LinkedIn response. Fortunately, this Department of Energy stood up and said, no way. And the other agencies right after that followed suit, even though they hadn't been given that request, and said, we're not releasing any names either. Things may change in terms of those departments once they're headed by Trump's appointees. But I think back to what happened in Canada when Stephen Harper took over as prime minister and the chill on science. And in fact, he started dismantling the ability of scientists to do research, to speak out, to even release accurate findings. And it called it a war on science. Science and technology are very closely linked in some ways. And I'm wondering how you see the incoming Trump administration as being a war on science and perhaps on the aspects of technology that are for the good of humanity.
You know, from my perspective, when I look at the incoming administration, and I've written a little bit about, I believe that society, and especially progressive society, will be assailed on all fronts. I mean, with thinking about Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, and certainly the reality of what we saw under the Bush-Cheney or Cheney-Bush administration over 8 years, the redaction of information coming out of EPA reports, or people like Rick Scott of Florida not even allowing the term climate change to be used, is it's a very dark time in terms of progress and human knowledge and unfettered research that is very, very important and it doesn't matter if you're in a red state or a blue state, if you're touched by somebody in your family or close relative or friend that has a debilitating disease, the only way that we're going to come up with cures for those diseases is the furtherance of science and respect for people in the scientific community. The other issue with respect to technology is, I think that Trump made it very clear that he wants to establish a Muslim registry, which should anybody that has any concern about human rights, that is a chilling statement. Anybody that can, understand history and those types of registries that single out a class or group of people can be so harmful that we must, as a society, and I mean, I would implore all of my technology peers to simply not be involved in an effort like that.
Actually, a friend of mine posted, when I posted your letter on my Facebook page, he responded and he said, "Does this mean that Oracle is going to set up the Muslim registry?" And I responded back, and I'm not sure how you'll take this, but I responded back and said, "Well, maybe they'll do as good a job with that as they did with Cover Oregon's website."
A simple database for Oracle, being a database company, actually will have far less complexity than the issues surrounding Cover Oregon. I totally understand what you mean.
As an Oregonian. Actually, I think that's a really important point there. That's probably one reason why Trump is enlisting the help of tech companies. What other thoughts do you have in terms of ways that tech companies could be helping the creeping rise of fascism that we're really afraid that we're seeing now?
Well, I think that there's an incredible amount of intellectual capacity and energy in technology companies. I think it's been an area where there has been incredible growth over the last generation in America and around the world. And so, I would advocate a good friend, John DeGraff, talks about work and life balance and talks about, our focus on working harder and longer, really for less. And so, if you're in a technology company on the leading edge that already is embracing, volunteerism among your employee community, somebody like a Salesforce or others that are actively involved, donating time and capacity of your people to making sure that progressive technology, things, and it, not just progressive, Barbara, but I mean things that are working to really strengthen America and put us back on a road in which we can realize our own aspirations of democracy and away from these Trump policies. And the Trump policies themselves I see as really being a full assault on democracy, the type of concentration of wealth that we will see under the Trump administration, I'm certain, is antithetical to eventually being able to move closer to a real democracy and being a beacon for the rest of the world in terms of our potential as a nation.
I'm just hoping it's not going to take 13 years as it did to get rid of the Nazis in Germany. But we're talking this morning with George Polzner, who publicly resigned from Oracle after his CEO expressed support for Trump last month. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. Did you have any sense, and did your colleagues at Oracle have any sense that your CEO was going to take such a public stand in support of Trump?
It was an absolute surprise, I think, to many who contacted me privately and who were very disappointed. You know, certainly there was a meeting of technology industry leaders that preceded Safra joining the transition team. And, you know, I don't take any, I don't have any bad or negative thoughts about, you know, Tim Cook and, you know, others that participate in a meeting, because I do think that that's important. I think that's important as a leader of technology companies to express, you know, we are here to help you if it's about, you know, creating more opportunities for America, if it's about strengthening our economy, if it's about strengthening our country. But when it comes to things that are really going to overstep and have the potential to be used in a very egregious or horrific way, I would expect all of the leadership to say, you know, we are not going to step over that line. We're here for America. We're not here for an agenda that is going to be harmful to the American people and to the rest of the world.
Well, did any of the other tech leaders that were in that meeting come out as strongly in support of Trump as Safra Katz did?
I recall that I think the CEO of IBM sent a letter to the Trump team saying something similar to Safra, that we're here to help you. And I do recall that there was a petition that was started by IBM technologists and rank and file workers distancing themselves from their CEO. So I think that there were some expressions of support, but certainly Safra joining the team and issuing the statement that she made publicly was probably the strongest embrace of the Trump administration among everyone that participated in the meetings.
So what was the response across the board in Oracle when she made that statement and joined the transition team?
You know, it's hard to say what it would be across the board. I do know that the private, there were some certainly negative comments that came from Oracle people that I did not know. And some of them were in the sales organization. And so perhaps they saw it as an opportunity to get a better review or bonus from Oracle. But most of the private messages I received were very positive and very appreciative. Some mentioned the fact that they would love to do something similar, but simply just didn't have the economic means to do so at this present time. And so I would say that the private messages were far more supportive. But across the board, it's been fairly limited, Barbara. So, you know, Oracle employs thousands of people around the world. And so I would say I've probably only had 30 or 40 messages. So it's really not an important statistical sampling.
Well, a friend of mine who's a performance artist out in Astoria, Oregon, responded to the email that I sent out about the show a couple days ago. And she thought this was a great strategy for organizing. And I wonder, is it, or do you think that this is not effective enough to really spread out throughout the corporate community and get more people in the corporate world on board with actively resisting Trump?
You know, I think that there absolutely are very meaningful political and economic actions that we can take on a large scale as a society. And I'm working on that right now with a small team of volunteers on a platform that will effectively, you know, when you think about flash mobs, you know, they're great in terms of calling attention to an issue. Marches are great at calling attention to issues, but there needs to be a mechanism for a sustained action. And that's primarily what we're turning our attention to. I wouldn't expect everyone to just get up and quit. I think that I would, however, if the administration is implementing some policies that are just really bad policy. I mean, I'm deeply concerned about the repeal of the ACA and its impact on healthcare for millions of Americans. And so I think that it's important to be marching in the street. It's important to be calling attention to this, not only to demonstrate to the rest of the world that that America has a lot of very aware and concerned citizens, but also to demonstrate to elected officials, our senators, Congress, state and local government, that people are very, very concerned and do not want the type of draconian policies that are likely to emanate from this administration.
Well, one project that I've been very intrigued by is, I think it's called the Indivisible Project, and they have put together a handbook of how to organize, basically based along the Tea Party lines of how you really harass and harangue your local public officials, elected officials, so that they listen to you. And it was kind of like Tea Party politics without the hatred, without the violence, and without the lack of facts and idiocy. And I read their handbook, and I was inspired by it until I got to the point where it said, you need to contact your own elected officials. They're not going to listen to anybody who's out of their district. So here I am living in Portland. My two senators are on our side. My congressman is on my side. In fact, most of our congress people are. So I'm looking at, well, how do I, here in Oregon, in a little blue bubble, really try to make some kind of effect on the politicians that we need to really hammer home that they're not representing our needs? How do we reach out to the red areas?
That's a not only an excellent question, but I just got back from San Francisco having a meeting with a very large progressive organization about that issue. You know, if Mitch McConnell gets an electronic petition with 500,000 signatures from California, I think he's just going to smile politely and go on being Mitch McConnell. The issue is when he starts hearing from his base that they don't want the ACA to go away or other issues, you know, it really has to be their constituents. And so we're very fortunate here in Oregon, with the exception of Dennis Richardson and Measure 97, we're very fortunate to generally have really an excellent group of elected officials. I know out here in State District 10, David Gomberg is absolutely wonderful. He's everywhere. He's really engaged with the community, both from a business perspective as well as progressive organizations. Similarly, Arnie Roblin, our senator for State District 5, is wonderful to work with. And there are a lot of great people, and so we're fortunate here. But as you say, the issue is, what do we do about, you know, Paul Ryan, and what do we do about Mitch McConnell and their constituency? And I think that there's an incredible amount of work ahead with respect to information and education, and also really shifting dialogue. And that's another area where we're focused. It's something that I think of as outcome-based dialogue. And what that means is, it doesn't matter if you live in Topeka, Kansas, and you vote conservatively, or you're living in Marin County and vote for the Green Party. There are fundamental things that we share as Americans. For example, you don't want to turn the kitchen tap on and get flammable, toxic, foul-smelling goo coming out of the faucet to serve water to your family, unless maybe you're Dick Cheney. And so I think that there are common things that we want. And I think that what we must do over the next 2 years is to have those discussions based on common values and common thinking, so that we're not just simply yelling at each other, because we do need red voters living in other areas to understand these issues in a non-defensive way. We can't tell them that they're idiots. We can't tell them that they're ignorant. We have to really engage them. And you know, dating back many years, it's something that progressives have had a really tough time doing, and that is really using a Dr. George Lakoff term, framing our values and presenting them in a cohesive and very simple way. Because I think if most Americans understood what it meant to be a progressive liberal, that it's not about giving things away, that, you know, we're about working hard, but we're also about the strength of our communities and diversity. And, you know, we are stronger together. And it's helping people understand that it's when people talk about, I built that, it's important for them to understand what really happened, how things really did get built, and that it is a community effort, and it is a national effort.
Well, we saw an interesting turn of events. The very first act that the Congress tried to do when they returned to session on January 3rd was to kind of disembowel the Office of Ethics, of Congressional Ethics. And they voted on that, and then in a secret vote, basically. I'm not even sure how word got out. I found out about it just before I went to bed on Tuesday night. By Wednesday morning, it had been repealed. And I understand that there was a huge outcry. And there were two reasons why they redid the vote and undid what they had done the night before. And though Donald Trump had also come out against it, because I guess he or his advisors saw that it was such a politically idiotic move to make and so transparently self-serving. But they also got flooded with phone calls and emails, and people, their constituents, were really outraged and upset. And I wonder, why were people so outraged and upset about that and so vocal, and that the Congress responded to that, and yet people are outraged and upset about all of Trump's cabinet picks, and we're seeing a lot of outrage about that too, but it seems like it's not having the same impact that vote that they had taken to destroy the Office of Ethics, the Congressional Office of Ethics, had. And I mean, and a lot of my friends, we've been talking about this for like the last week, like, why isn't there the same outrage, or is the outrage being stifled, or what's happening now?
You know, I'm actually deeply suspicious, and I typically am not. I try to really kind of follow things in a very rational way, but I almost think that the whole the vote, the secret vote, and then Trump tweeting, you know, there are other more important things that we should be dealing with first. I really think that that was scripted. I think that that was essentially a acknowledgement that there's going to be a lot of controversy with the Trump inauguration, the issue with hacked elections and the Russians, and certainly very, very controversial. I could not go out and pick worse people in a cabinet to essentially administer the particular areas that his cabinet picks would be responsible for. I really think that this was done to make Donald Trump look like a hero to the people, that he is actually paying attention. And it is antithetical to the patterns that we see about everything else. I mean, there is an absolute outrage about Rex Tillerson, who in my mind is an environmental terrorist as opposed to somebody we should be considering as Secretary of State. And there is an absolute outcry, but to no avail. The pick of Jeff Sessions as AG, you know, with his racist past, in terms of, you know, what we would be looking at as very regressive, a very regressive approach to the Department of Justice is deeply outrageous and disconcerting. But the ethics vote being overturned by a Trump tweet, I really think that that was a tactical move. And I think that, you know, when I think about the Trump administration, Barbara, I think about David Copperfield. I think we're going to see a lot of misdirection, you know, we're going to be assailed on all fronts vigorously. But I think that the real motivation behind the Trump administration is about concentration of wealth, elimination of estate taxes, which in my mind is a death blow to an aspiration of democracy, and also the relationship, the strategic relationship that Tillerson has with the Russians and the Russian petroleum industry, and the opening of the Arctic for the oil reserves in the Arctic. I really think that that's what it's all about.
Well, we're talking this morning with George Paulsner, who publicly resigned from Oracle after his CEO expressed support for Trump and joined the Trump transition team. And we're talking this morning about the reasons, first of all, the reasons why George wrote the letter and resigned publicly, but we're now getting into the kind of the heart and the meat of what we have to look ahead. Well, one of the things I thought was very interesting this week is two people that Trump took on in his tweets, and they're two American icons, and they couldn't be different. One is Meryl Streep, and the other one is John Lewis. And when I see him doing that, my sense is that's really overreaching. I saw an article this morning in the Washington Post that John Lewis's book sales on Amazon are through the roof. They're up 100,000%. So what do you think about some of the attacks that he's making? And do you think that this shows any way that he can be effective? I know that I'm as scared as you are about the hidden agenda of these people, but I wonder if Trump's buffoonery may actually undermine some of their ability to achieve the agenda that they have.
You know, I think that they're very disciplined. I think that when I say they, I mean, I'm talking about Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and the GOP in terms of what they want. And I think, quite frankly, he serves them very well. His buffoonery serves them very well in the respect that it does make us forget. All through the campaign, this was something that was very successful, that he would misdirect. The press was following him. He had so much time, media time, which is so valuable if you're trying to run any kind of campaign. And so I think it'll actually serve them well, unless, of course, he gets us into a nuclear war with North Korea and China. Then nobody will really be served very well. But I don't think he's a complete buffoon. I think he certainly knows what he's doing to a limited extent. And I think that the GOP will effectively use him. And if they cannot, if they get to the point where they feel that he's lost his value to them, I would look for them to perhaps begin impeachment, because Mike Pence is a fundamental extremist. And will be just as bad as Trump, perhaps without the extreme foreign affairs volatility. But so I think that the GOP knows what they're doing. I think that they've told Trump, or perhaps have at least said, we'll work together as long as we're working together. And if we're not, then we have alternatives to remove you.
Well, what is your thought about the best way forward? I mean, there's demonstrations going on all this week, huge demonstrations planned for Saturday, the Women's March, and then here in Portland, there's going to be a labor march at 10, meeting at Shabansky Park, at the Park Blocks, at Salmon and Park Blocks in downtown Portland, and then at noon, the Women's March starts from Tomacall Park. And there's demonstrations, I mean, you know, in Washington, D.C., they're expecting hundreds of thousands of people. And it's interesting to hear that being the projection, because often the projections are in these kind of marches are really underestimate the number of people who show up. So there's this outpouring of opposition. Do you see that this is going to have some effect?
I do. I think it's incredibly important for a number of reasons, but I do think that we have to look beyond the marches. And we really need to stop quibbling over emails and whether Bernie's sweeping style of change or Hillary's incremental style of change is best for us, because when we're divided, as divided as we are, we get Trump or we get something potentially worse. And so the reason that I think that we made so many great societal gains in the 1960s is because labor came together with the civil rights movement and the women's movement. And there were so many people that were joining together. And as a reaction to that, the Lewis Powell memo architected and really accounted for all of the concern among people, the wealthy CEOs, that all of these people were coming together, unions were becoming too strong. And what we've seen since the Lewis Powell memo is just, as much as I deplore the policies of the GOP, they've implemented and executed incredibly well.
I just want to back up. Ahead. Can you just restate what the Lewis Powell memo was?
So in a nutshell, and for anybody that hasn't really studied the U.S. history, the Lewis Powell memo. Lewis Powell became a Supreme Court justice under, I think he'd been appointed by Reagan, if I'm not mistaken. But what he did is in the 1960s, as people started coming together in protest of the Vietnam War, and hippies were terrific. I mean, they were challenging our value system and convention and getting us to really think about nature instead of just, you know, making money and buying TVs and hyper-consumerism. The unions were becoming strong in addressing, you know, getting workers paid reasonably well for the fruits of their labor. The civil rights movement and Voter Rights Act and other things. So Lewis Powell, a lot of CEOs were very, very concerned that American citizens were becoming too powerful, and the wealthy, you know, were this very small minority, and they started feeling very concerned. And so Lewis Powell looked at the situation in America and wrote very powerfully and eloquently an architecture for Republicans, the GOP, conservatives to follow to achieve political power and success. And so it talked about we need to fund think tanks. And so out of that, we have the Heritage Foundation. We have, we have things like ALEC that have come out of the memo. He talked about the fact that most professors and most colleges and universities in the 60s were liberal, and that there needs to be a right-wing influence in colleges and universities. And of course, you know, now there is. He talked about, he really laid out a brilliant architecture, and we've never really effectively responded to that. And so part of the work that I'm doing now is a platform that will effectively, if we're fortunate enough and achieve the kind of momentum and scale that we need, will allow us to effectively counter this conservative machine that was built really back in the early 1980s. The policies under Ronald Reagan, when you look at the economic policies that effectively came out of this Republican machine, you know, that's when worker wages started to flatten and CEOs and executive pay, you know, continued to rise in lockstep with worker productivity. And so clearly the memo and the economic policies of the GOP worked to shift power to and created this huge abyss between the 1% and the 99%.
Well, I've been reading this book about conservatism, and makes the point that Donald Trump is a natural conclusion to decades of what the writer calls free market fundamentalism, and he calls it the freedom fraud that's being promoted by the conservative movement, which he thinks has really lost its touch with what was traditional conservatism back, let's say, during the Ronald Reagan days. And he sees a direct continuum between what started during Reagan and what's continued and has wound up with Trump. Do you see that that's actually maybe the connection to what you're talking about with the Powell memo?
It's certainly part of it. Economic power yields political power, especially in after Reagan did quite a bit to eviscerate the fairness doctrine from the FCC. And then leading up to the Supreme Court decision, FEC versus Citizens United versus FEC and McCutcheon versus FEC with respect to campaign finance law.
Well, one last thing before we head towards Friday and the actual inauguration of Donald Trump. What do you see that people can do in particular to perhaps stop some of these cabinet nominations from going through, in particular Tillerson, who it sounds like does not have the votes to get recommended out of the committee. And the other one, Betty DeVos seems like she's kind of controversial. And then I had heard that Ben Carson had a really kind of shaky hearing, as they said.
So I think that continued pressure on electeds with respect to letter writing and phone calls are important. I don't know if we're going to be successful at derailing some of these awful people. I mean, I don't even think of it as a possibility, Barbara. I think that Betsy DeVos and Jeff Sessions and Rex Tillerson and Greg Pruitt, really the whole list what's sad to me is when you're selecting cabinet people and probably the sanest, most rational person has a nickname Mad Dog, that that's a problem, right?
Right.
And so I think that right now we have to use what we have. But part of the work that I've got going with a handful of volunteers from the tech space is a platform in which we could direct large scale economic and political activism and really move beyond petitions into real collective massive actions that I think will impact the bottom lines of companies, which will then place pressure on elected officials as well as direct political action.
Well, George, I'd love to talk to you some more about this in a few months and see how you're doing, because it sounds like the work you're doing is really some of the work that needs to happen.
I would absolutely love it. Thank you, Barbara.
We'll continue the conversation. And if I haven't already expressed it, you're one of my heroes. I really appreciate talking to you today, ever since I read that article in The Guardian about you last month. So we'll be out in the streets on Saturday for sure. And I'm sure you'll be. What community, by the way, do you live in?
I'm out in the Lincoln City, Newport area, and I know Nancy Mead and the folks from the National Organization for Women are organizing actions here. And so I'm looking forward to participating here.
Great. And I'll be here in Portland. So thanks very much for joining us, George.
Thank you again, Barbara.
We've been talking with George Polisner, who publicly resigned from Oracle after his CEO expressed support for Trump and joined the Trump transition team. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be talking about the plight of the most endangered species, which after Trump's inauguration may soon include all of us. My guest will be Bill DeBuise, who's the author of The Last Unicorn. My engineer is Terrell Lowry. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I want to wish everybody a good Martin Luther King Day, and let's go out and celebrate it with the memory of what Dr. King stood for, as we need that guidance ever more in the next few years. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. See you Saturday at the Women's March at noon at Tahmacall Park. Thanks for listening.
struggle in the darkness, troubling.